supportive counseling. In all our lives, we encounter situations that we would like to correct, people who we feel could perhaps do better than they're doing, people who we see are going in wrong directions and would do well to receive good advice. And we are motivated in speaking about these things from two basic premises. One is that we don't like the situation that is being created. We feel loyal to a particular situation, let's say, that has been that has existed, and we don't like the intrusion into that situation that somebody else's energies are bringing. In other words, when we say anything, we're saying it not from a standpoint of helping them, but of helping a situation. And in such circumstances, very often what we will do is speak very harshly, or we will speak without at all thinking about whether it will help the person or not, because we're not trying to think of helping the person. This kind of counseling, or hardly counseling, nagging, criticism, whatever you might want to call it, it has its own justification at certain times, but rarely. In other words, for example, if somebody is a criminal and comes to your home with a gun, and he's about to shoot up your family, it's simply not appropriate for you to worry about counseling him. Your concern is for your family. And whatever his motives may be, he may have had a mother who beat him, he may have had a father who deserted him, or his mother, he may have had a miserable childhood, all of these things may have made him what he is, but that's not your problem. Your problem is how to keep him from shooting up the people that you're responsible for, and by extension, how to keep him from shooting up society. It would be a good thing to simply report him to the police if you can. I was delighted with Prahlad's answer to somebody who stole something from one of our people here at Ananda. And this man said, well, why didn't you tell me first before telling the police? And Prahlad said, well, maybe it's because you didn't tell us before you stole it. It was a classic answer. Sometimes you just don't much care about the situation, or about the person, I mean. You're interested in the situation. But certainly it's always better if you can accomplish both ends. Because if you can win the other person, ultimately you've gotten him to beat his sword into plowshares. You've created peace. Ultimately, you've brought about a situation where everyone is benefited, but most of all yourself. The whole purpose in right behavior, ultimately, is to be traced back to what it does for us. When you put out a certain kind of energy, it's sort of like making grooves in a record. Once the groove is there, it will always produce that sound. And so you put a particular groove in your brain by action, by thoughtful action, that is to say, as Patanjali said about ahimsa, nonviolence, that what he was really counseling was not desiring to harm, rather than sometimes you can't help killing, you can't help harming, just as you drive down the highway and a beetle gets stuck on your windshield. You can't help that, really, except by not driving. Then you'll walk and you'll step on the beetle. There's no way that we can avoid doing harm in one way or another in this world. The world is simply not set up to make it possible. The Jain sadhus in India wear a cloth mask over their faces so they won't inhale germs. And they boil their water before drinking it, so they won't kill the germs when they drink it. But of course they kill the germs when they boil the water. And they do fanatical things like hiring people to lie on beds full of bedbugs so the bedbugs too can get a good feast. And this idea of having such total compassion for all life that you deliberately try to love even those things that normally your heart would not go out to. This is the thinking. Incidentally, yes, even bedbugs seem to have a certain amount of humanity. They've made recordings of them approaching a human body, and they squeal with delight. If you can, they've turned it up very high. Of course, it's softer than the human ear can hear, and perhaps had to bring it down to a pitch that we can hear, but That's what they do with great enthusiasm when they approach. So all things, when you enter into them, they have their life, but you can't help doing harm. What you can help is wanting to do harm. This is the important thing, that kind of action which you do, not absent-mindedly or in ignorance or whatever, that is less effect, but that kind of action which you perform with full concentration, with full will, this leaves grooves in your brain, and this is what we see with people who achieve power by harsh means, let's say. Or to take an example that we can see all the time in our country, unfortunately, people who achieve position in government by the only means that can enable a person in this day and age, in this country, to achieve a position in government. Almost the only means. It's very, very difficult for honest people to get up there, for the simple reason that they have to be nominated, and the people who have the power to nominate them exert that power in order to get something out of them, and before they know it, they have to sell themselves out to this power group and that power group, this interest and that, to the point where they really are bought. Very few are able to resist that. And their rationale, assuming them to be honest in the first place, which I imagine many of them are, many of them enter politics from a sincere desire to effect a beneficial change. They will think, well, but when I have power, I'll be able to do some good. Whereas just one vote at the polls, what good can I do? So they figure, well, if it takes this to get power, okay. But what happens is that slowly that kind of unprincipled compromise, ordinary compromise is fine and necessary, but unprincipled compromise is wrong. And that kind of compromise, these people gradually, by submitting to, become changed. So that after a little while, they first of all begin thinking, well, everybody does it, so it can't be all that wrong, or even if it's wrong, after all, we're only human. And it isn't a very long leap from that thought to the further one of, I'm only human, and so why not? And so it goes, that these people will gradually sell themselves out to the point where their actions, their little bit of unprincipled compromises over a period of time, make them basically people you couldn't trust with a penny. Even if they get into power by principled means, they haven't any chance really to do anything, simply because the bureaucracy is so top-heavy. I don't think Jesus Christ could do anything in the office of the presidency, because the bureaucracy is far stronger than the presidency. It's the thing we don't elect. It's the thing that's always there. It's the thing that can just sort of conveniently put that beautiful bill that was just passed in a drawer and make it drag out for a long time before anything really happens. The actions that we perform and the situations that we get into, all of these things etch themselves into our consciousness, the helplessness that we allow ourselves to get into, the rage that people will feel when they are talking. This is another thing that happens to these politicians. They talk, the only way they can get people to vote for them is to talk against something else. No politician is likely to get elected if he's going to say, well, my opponent is a fine man and I completely endorse everything that he stands for. I too have some good things to say. This is not the way anybody seems to get elected. They can only get elected by calling everyone except with a view except their own total scoundrel. And thus, by constantly denouncing others, even with tongue-in-cheek, gradually they develop this denunciatory attitude toward life. And they seem very sort of self-righteous and so on. Any kind of attitude that is part of trying to change anything, we must understand that the most important thing that it changes, and perhaps in a way the first thing that it changes, is us. If we think of changing the world, the first thing we have to think of is changing ourselves. And if we wish to change the world in a way that will also change us in a good way, then we have to change it not accusatorily, not with criticism, but basically supportively. You can't nag people into changing themselves. The more you nag, the more firm they will be that even if they finally recognize that you're right, they'll never admit it to you. They'll change. They'll be sort of closet converts. They'll act differently every time when you're not around, but they'll make sure that they act the old way when you're there. Usually, people will be this way. Some people will be enough out of their egotism to be humble enough to admit frankly, but it's pretty hard when somebody's nagged you for a long time, and a lot easier when that person has talked to you as your friend. Supportive counseling, also in the sense that we really mean it, must begin with you. It must begin with what you are trying to bring out of yourself. And the most important thing of all is to recognize where you fit in that picture. For example, I know that my guru used to sometimes scold people very severely. I can't scold people severely because if I did, it would upset me. And if ever I reach the point where I won't feel upset by it, then I'll feel clearer. And sometimes I feel more free to do it because I won't get upset than others. And so sometimes I do, but not the way he did, I'll tell you that. You'd think the roof was coming off the way he did sometimes. And he did it for our welfare. He didn't do it with any kind of personal anger or personal upset or anything. It was not as if he was involved in it at all. It was just something that we drew out of him because of where we were and what we needed. I would look into his eyes and I would see this regret in his eyes that he had to talk so strongly. But he knew that if he didn't talk strongly, he would not get the point across. And as a result, he could say the truth again and again and again, but for what motive? His purpose was to say it in such a way that we would really listen. And that depended on the psychology of the individual. I remember, for example, with my own childhood, a lot of people have written about the pros and cons of spanking children. Well, I can give you the answer to that perfectly well from my own upbringing. It depends on the child. You can't say categorically it isn't good or it is good. Because, for example, my brother was much more of a physical type. And as a result, he had to be reached in physical ways. And if my parents spanked him, it was the only way they could get his attention. And when he was spanked, he forgot it immediately. But I couldn't be approached that way because I was more of a mental type. And the only way to really discipline me was by showing me where I was wrong. And or making me feel that they disapproved and leaving me to try to understand why they disapproved. But spanking me was the worst way to treat me, the best way to treat him. I remember one time they spanked me. They didn't very often because they knew this, but one time they got really upset with me. What happened was that they had just painted the bathroom, and I thought how beautiful it looks. Let me improve it. Let me add my artistic touch to this beauty. So I took a screwdriver and drew a beautiful star on the lovely paint. And they were furious, naturally, and I was just outraged that they should not appreciate my artistic contribution to the household. And so they spanked me, and 2 weeks later I looked at Dad and I said, "Why did you spank me?" And they realized then that they shouldn't have. There must have been a better way of going at it. But it depends upon the psychology of the individual, as Jeeves puts it. It depends on understanding the person, but first of all, it depends on who you are and where you're coming from. Don't do that, even if it's needed, which will do harm to you. If you scold angrily, for example, you will be somehow upsetting and your own equilibrium. That anger will affect you. Far better, even if that person needs it desperately, far better to realize that your first responsibility is to be in tune yourself. And thus, for example, I don't scold people because I'm not yet clear enough on whether I'm talking from God or from my own self. I may think I'm talking from God, but I'm not sure. If I'm upset about something, then maybe I just don't know. So for my own sake, not for yours, so don't feel glad that I don't scold you, I'm much less likely to do it. But as I grow gradually in myself, I find that I don't need to worry as much about some of these things, and I can come on a little bit more definitely. Otherwise, remember this point, that what you put out, the first slate you write on is the slate of your own mind. And so, what do you want to put out? What do you want to become? Any kind of negative thought is going to make you more negative. And you won't be able to change the world. The world's going to go on as it is, and if you finally get rid of one particular nagging problem, it'll just step aside for others. It's sort of like an army coming through a very narrow pass, and you kill one soldier and the next one steps in. You can't ever kill the whole army. You'll get exhausted long before that. You can't ever solve all the host of problems in this world. And so the important thing first is to understand what you can put out, how you can put it out, in order to become what you want to be. What do you want to be? Loving? Why? Because you're happy when you love and unhappy when you don't. Quite a decent enough reason. In fact, it wouldn't really hurt us at all to become selfish in a spiritual as opposed to an egotistical way, because that's the only valid motive for moral law. You don't do good things merely because the Bible tells you, and you'll go to hell if you don't. You don't do good things merely because society has passed a law or because your neighbors hold certain expectations of you. These are not ways of doing good in the best possible way. If there's no neighbor looking over the fence, how are you going to behave? If you can get away with breaking the law, what does it matter? And after all, God can take care of himself, so why should it matter whether you please him? None of those reasons are satisfactory. The only basic reason for which any person, whether he be a saint or master or ordinary human being, is divine selfishness as opposed to egoic selfishness. Egoic selfishness means I take something from you because it's going to be good for me. Divine selfishness means I may give it to you because it's good for me. But good for me in what way? Because, well, I bought you and therefore you're going to do something good to me? No. It's better to do good for such motives than not to do good at all. But what I'm really talking about is, in speaking of divine selfishness, is that I understand that you are my own self, and that what I do for you, I already have done for me. In other words, I expand this ego from this little prison that it's in to infinity. All moral law is to be understood in that way. The very basis of moral law is the search for freedom and expansion and joy. You could use any one of those words to define moral law. You do kind deeds because it frees you of the prison of egotism. It gives you joy. In giving other people joy, your own joy expands. You find joy in the very act of giving because you realize that they are a part of yourself. And why do you tell the truth? Why should you tell the truth? Well, because if you get out of touch with truth, you get out of touch with what is, and you start getting yourself more and more deeply into delusion. It's for your own sake that you should tell the truth, and also for the sake of being in tune with that reality of which you are merely an expression, so that you can become an instrument for that. So that, for example, when you speak, your words have power because you always speak the truth. People who don't speak the truth may often speak with a lot of vigor, but somehow they don't have power. It's like paper bullets being shot out of a gun. Full vigor, but it doesn't put a dent in anything. So the reason for every single moral principle might be seen in these terms of divine selfishness rather than human selfishness. Divine selfishness means God has given us these laws because these are the laws of our own nature. If we act in accordance with these laws, we will be able to act in the best way possible, and we will be the most in tune with him. Whereas if we act against those, we get out of tune with our nature, and everything seems to go wrong. So now, what do you want? Why do you want to love? You want to love not merely because it's good to love. Why is it good to love? Because somebody says so, even in the Bible. Why should that make it good? Prove it that it's good. Why should it be good? You want to love others so that they will love you. That's just egoism. But you want to love because loving is your nature, because it's a joy to love, because when you love in this way, you get in tune with the divine flow. Or to put it in purely human terms, you're happier when you love than when you don't love. This is a very easy motive for forgiving other people, for example. That you're unhappy if you don't. Somebody will hurt you whom you love deeply. And you get all upset and bitter and hate humanity and resolve never to love again and so on. Who suffers most? You. And if you can really come up with an attitude that, after all, if I love this person truly, and she doesn't love me truly, then there's something that's wrong in her. And if it's wrong in her, she's out of equilibrium, and she will feel pain. And therefore, out of my love for her, I should forgive her all the more. This is God's love, that He forgives the sinners even more than the saints, because they need it more, because He can feel their pain. Man doesn't see that, but that's how it is. Well, then, every one of the attitudes that you want to project on others, if you act that way first yourself, your purpose shouldn't be that then you're setting an example so they will behave right. Put it squarely where it really belongs to begin with, that you need to be that yourself. And then you need to put out that kind of energy toward others, as a means of helping them because you love them, as a means of straightening out unpeaceful situations because who wants them, but above all, as a means of helping you to affirm in yourself those qualities that you want to develop. Now, everybody is willing and happy, even in a very somewhat negative way, happy to correct everyone but themselves, happy to tell the world where it should get off, happy to point out all the reasons why the world is bugging them, and just telling them that they wish the world would behave. But in truth, if you will realize why you want to help others, why you want to, because it's an extension of helping yourself, then we can turn it to the next question. How do you like to help yourself? When you do wrong things, are you likely to say, you jackass? Not seriously. Very few people. I doubt that anybody really thinks of himself as a sinner, really thinks of himself as evil. Even people who are criminals, even people who are depraved, they will usually find some excuse for it because nobody can completely accept a bad image of himself. Basically, because we're all children of God. They'll all find some excuse. They're supportive to themselves, aren't they? They'll try to give themselves every break, but they won't do it for other people. Well, if we really want to help other people in the way that we want to help ourselves, then we should help them supportively. Supportively in this sense, but it's much more than that. It's that the very fact that people criticize and nag and complain when they talk to other people in ways, corrective ways, what they're really showing is that they, on some level, don't treat themselves right either. They'd like to, and they always try to find excuse, but basically there's always something else there, that if they don't like others, they don't like themselves. If they're being hard on others, they're also being hard on themselves. They'd like to be supportive, but the more they put out that unsupportive energy toward others, the more they develop that unsupportive attitude toward themselves. If you really want to help yourself, you should help others with that attitude, not only because it affirms this supportive thing in you, or perhaps I should say basically because it affirms this supportive attitude in you. When you approach people in that way, there's one further thing, and this is in our title of our talk this morning, The Art of Supportive Counseling. It really is an art. You can't reduce it to a science. A science is the techniques, the ways of handling people. If you become a counselor and study how to do counseling, they'll tell you certain things to look for, certain things to do. This will be the science of it, certain rules that people have learned over a long period of time. But the art of it is something that can't ever be really conveyed. It's something that you can absorb from other people, absorb from those people who really have that kind of compassion, that kind of understanding. but it's really something that will always remain on an intuitive level. It isn't something that you can reduce to rules and say, oh, this is how I do it. It's something that will require basically your own intuitive response at the time of the situation. I can tell you the science of it, but I can't teach you the art of it. I can only sort of talk around the art. I can hope to convey what little I may know on the subject. But if you think too much in terms of how you end up, it's almost like somebody declaring his love for his girlfriend by reading a book and handy phrases, like the tourist traveling in another country. He looks it up and, oh, I love you. You make me feel warm inside. And so on. It wouldn't work so well. Similarly, I remember times, for instance, a few years ago, I had a radio interview and I had a very difficult question to think about. And I thought of all the various possible ways of answering, different ways that he might pose that question. And I found that there were so many of them that I could never, if he asked them right like that on the air, get into my mental file box and pull out the right answer right then. It would be much too difficult. If I were writing a book, I might be able to do it and have my convenient reference file here that I could sort of thumb through and, yes, but you can't really do that when you're on the air talking with somebody, and you can't do that when you're counseling either. Somebody says something that calls for an instant response. Just a minute. Oh, yeah. No, you'll lose all spontaneity that way. What I found, therefore, was that I put all those possible things out of my mind, and I merely sort of thought around it rather than directing my energy right at it. And I found that by thinking around it, what I was really doing was getting myself in a central position to all of these different approaches. And from that center, I was able to answer him when he asked me very well. I was able to answer instantly because I was coming from my center and could go in any direction that I had to go in order to reply properly. Well, that's a very, very basic part of, and it's an art more than a science, but I can at least tell you how to do this thing. It's sort of like a bridge between the two, that if you are really centered in yourself, if you understand that it's from here that it all begins, not there, that's when you'll be able to handle the situation best. This is true for all human situations, because counseling becomes a pretty fine line. You don't always want to counsel, and yet you may want to help. You may not always want to help, but you may want to amuse. You may not always want to amuse, but you may want to distract. In one way or another, we are always trying to influence other people. And I don't mean in negative ways. I mean perhaps that you're at a party and you're telling a joke. You want people to listen and you want people to laugh. That's influencing other people. I don't mean anything Machiavellian, and I don't mean anything complex, necessarily. But we are always, in one context or another, as long as we're dealing with people, we're trying to have some kind of effect. And the principles that we're talking about here basically are all the same. They don't change, except perhaps in degree. When we're working with people, the most effective way to reach them with who you are, and the most effective way of growing in the process of reaching out to people, both ends are accomplished by this. The most effective way is to be centered in yourself. If you can work from that inner center, you will be able to reach out to them wherever they come from. And another interesting thing is that you will touch them at their center. So much talk. I was with some people recently, not people here, who were just talking the usual kind of chatter that you hear in the world, everybody having a story to tell that would top somebody else's story, everybody waiting for a chance to tell his story, and everybody talking at once and loudly, the typical worldly kind of situation. In that kind of situation, who listens to who? Who listens to whom? Nobody. There's a story about Franklin Delano Roosevelt at a cocktail party going around and telling people, "I just killed my mother." And he was just waiting to see if anybody responded. And people said, "Oh, how nice. And you know what I did yesterday?" And then somebody else would say, "Well, it's high time, you know." And then he'd go on. Nobody in that group responded in an appropriate manner because nobody had really heard. People talk and talk and talk and don't listen. And what's the use of trying to influence them on that level? You can't really do so anyway. But the more deeply centered you are in yourself, the more you'll really be able to reach out to them. That's why I don't really enjoy group situations where everybody's talking. One-on-one situations are much better. An audience is like one-on-one, too, because you're talking to everybody as an individual, and you're trying to reach his mind as a person. But it's not this kind of superficial thing that happens when everybody's talking at once. You can get deeper into it. When you're talking, it's far better if you're with people to just be with one person, talking deeply. I remember a party I was at, and I was talking with somebody, and somebody else came over and said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Philosophy." "Philosophy!" Yuck! Like this, and walked away. Well, that's why I don't think much of parties, but having that opportunity to get to know somebody on a deeper level than ordinary chatter, this is very meaningful. It brings out things that are meaningful to you. It brings out things that you can learn from, that will help you to grow. But it always depends on the level that you can touch people at. And that level always begins with you. For example, when people go to the saints and come away feeling suddenly as if they had a spiritual potential too. This is a very common reaction that people have in the magnetic presence of saints, that they feel from their magnetism something that they are perhaps better than they used to think they were. Why? Basically, because the saint is at his own center. And he's talking, therefore, to your center. You'll talk to people from whatever level you're at in yourself. And if you can talk to people from a deep level, you'll be able to touch them on a deep level. Thus, counseling, if it's understood in this way, counseling in the broader context of not merely sitting somebody down and saying, "Now listen, John, do you remember what you said to Mary yesterday? And is that really what you want to be saying to people?" And Not necessarily that kind of thing at all. But in the ordinary context of daily confabulation, that you will find that there is always some kind of rapport going on and some kind of influence that you're exerting. It will always come back to what you are, and in the very process of putting that out, you will deepen what you are. Also, you will enrich whatever you experience, because when you touch people on a level that really relates to something that's going on inside you, you will be able to find that they too may have experienced certain things that they can share with you. And that sharing needn't be on a intellectual or psychological level. The deepest kind of sharing of all isn't in words. It's a vibrational exchange. There are some people that you can be with and your life is changed. Or you can be with and you may not say a word, and yet you feel that there's some very meaningful interchange that has taken place. This is what we really would like to strive for in our relations with one another, that we can touch each other on those deeper levels. Now, how do we go about, in any case, trying to help people to accomplish the things that they want to accomplish? Many times we see to bring it from that deeper level to the ordinary human situation where we are aware that there's somebody who hasn't understood something that's very important, and it may be important to him, it may be important to us, it may be important to a group dynamic. Whatever it might be, how do you reach those people? What Are you trying to support is perhaps the best question to ask right now. There are many people who will approach this idea of counseling with an attitude to giving support to people, but will be all too prone to try to support their delusions. All too prone, well, it's sort of like that Peanuts cartoon many years ago. You must all have seen it, I think, because it was quite famous. But Lucy is being the psychiatrist and has her sign up. The psychiatrist is in, and Charlie Brown comes up and poses some problem to her. I forget what the problem was. And Lucy says, "You're no different from anybody else. That'll be 5 cents, please." Well, this kind of supportive counseling that leaves you nowhere, that's surely not what we're talking about. Somebody who was obese and a chain smoker went to take Scientology, and she came back from the training course to her office there in Los Angeles, and she was still chain smoking and was still obese, and they said, "Well, have you overcome these things?" And she said, "Well, no, but I've learned to accept them." Well, that too isn't necessarily decent counseling. Supportive counseling all too often takes you in that direction, however, that it tries to get you to not feel guilty, which is fine, tries to get you to accept yourself as you are, which is fine, but on the other hand, look at yourself in the mirror. Can you really like that? There has to be some level at which the answer will have to be no. You might be very beautiful, and you might be very athletic, and you might be very intelligent, and you might be eloquent, and you might be all sorts of things, gifted and charming and personable and popular, and so what if you don't know God? If you don't know what it's really at? As Yogananda said, the road to Hades is paved with good intentions, quoting obviously a well-known statement, but applying it to this sort of thing, where a person can be and do all sorts of good things, but leave out the one thing that's most important of all, which is God. We don't want to support ourselves in error. If we accept ourselves, what we should accept is two things, two levels. One is that this is what we really are, so that we can get to work on it, because you'll never get to work on something if you don't accept that it's there. You won't get to work on a problem if you can't see that there's a problem. And secondly, accept your deeper self so you won't hate yourself for having that problem. Because in fact, we are no different from anybody else. In fact, we do all have problems. In fact, we've got many things that we've got to overcome. As Sri Yukteswar said, the past lives of all men are dark with many shames. But everything in future will improve if you make the right spiritual effort now. And so to go at it in the right way, in the right context, we must accept that we are children of God. We must accept that basically we are perfect. But on the other hand, we must also face the imperfections that are in us and not hate ourselves for them, but get busy and work on them. Hatred is a useless emotion. I remember once weeping because of something that I had done. And I wept for a long time. And after I had wept, I realized that I was exhausted, and I was much farther away from being able to expiate or get rid of or whatever what I'd done wrong than before. And I realized then that it doesn't help for us merely to have a negative reaction. It's sort of like that example I've told you of the tennis match. Somebody shoots the ball onto the far side of the court, you don't wring your hands and say, "I don't like that ball." You get busy and try to figure out what you can do to get it. And if you see that it's not possible to get it, then you figure on the longer range thing that there's no point in exhausting myself running for something I can't get. Let me save my energy for the next ball and hope that I can get that one. In other words, you think in useful ways. You don't allow your emotions to color what you're doing. We need to learn to do that with our own emotions too, not to get upset with ourselves, not to hate ourselves, to learn to accept ourselves. If the alternative is to hate ourselves, this is certainly necessary. Guilt is a worthwhile emotion only if it will stir us to action of a positive type. But otherwise, it's merely a wasted emotion. In fact, it's subconsciously it tries to be its own expiation. You say, well, I know I didn't do right, but at least I feel guilty, so that makes it good, doesn't it? Well, it doesn't. What will make it good is if you go out, for example, and apologize. What will make it good is if you go out and try to help other people. If you put out another kind of energy that will be positive in such a way as to bring all that negative energy into a positive direction. You may have, for example, cheated a customer in your store. And given the probability that you won't be able to find that customer and pay him back, if you've reached the point where you understand that it was wrong to cheat that customer, then there's another way of expiating it, and that's to try to help other customers. In this way, indeed, a sin may be a great, great aid, because it gives you the incentive to get out there and do better. Whereas a person who's never been sinful and never been dishonest will never really try to be helpful. He'd be so sort of priggishly concentrated in his own smug self-satisfaction. Indeed, you needn't feel that badly about the mistakes that you make if you understand that they can be, and indeed are meant to be, incentives toward right action. So you don't need to feel badly and wallow in the feeling about it. We make too much of feeling. We make too much of emotion. What we should try to feel is, what is useful? What is a useful response? And what is the useful response? That which will help you to get out of a delusion, or that which will help you to strengthen a virtue. And the same kind of attitude should be directed toward other people. It's very often a mistake if you're trying to help people in a supportive way. Yes, you don't want to merely accept them as fine where they are. If you want to really help them, to win their friendship by saying, well, that's all right, Johnny, I know you're a drunk, but after all, you like it. Here's another whiskey. That's not being very helpful, is it? That could be considered supportive counseling by some, I suppose. But anybody with any brains at all is going to recognize that if he's trying to help somebody, he may have to go against what that person wants. Support may not be always support for the ego. Support may not always be support for a person's conscious self. You may, if you're really in it for the long term, which is the only thing worth sticking around for, because otherwise we'll stick around anyway, just a little longer. The only thing is always to think in long term. You have to be a long distance runner. You can't think just in terms of this particular moment, whether it be this satisfaction or this gain. Sometimes you will find that a person will be able to you'll make a person work on some particular quality, or inspire him to, or counsel him to, or whatever it might be. But strangely enough, that quality may be, even though disconcerting to others, a virtue in the context of his longer and overall evolution. For example, because it's hard to understand this sort of thing without any example at all, let's say that somebody has a tendency to get angry. Anger in itself is definitely a fault. It keeps us, it burns the brain cells, it keeps us totally uncentered in ourselves, it is the surest way back into further delusions, because it's the inevitable consequence of frustrated desire, and you get angry and then you just create more and more desires. But on the other hand, it's certainly imaginable that a person might be very lazy, and the only quality he has that generates energy is anger. In such a case, laziness is much more important to overcome than anger, because energy, if it's once generated, can then be directed in a positive way, but no energy at all can't be directed. And so it would be a mistake in such a case to tell somebody to overcome his anger. It would be rather the right kind of counseling to tell him to try to encourage him to be angry about the right things. And of course, you can't really be angry about the right things, but you can be angry about righter things. You can get all upset because the government has passed a wrong law. It's better to direct your energies that way than not to direct them at all. You can get righteously indignant, but with anger and so on too. And at least you're trying to help something. You don't always need to worry. This is the negative side of it, that by concentrating on, by allowing him to continue anger, it may help him to overcome another quality. But there's something else too, and that is that sometimes a person will have a very strong virtue which he can really do something with, and certain very bad faults which he can't really do anything with at all. What do you talk about? If you're wise, you'll try to help him to develop that virtue. You won't really talk about those faults because you know that they're beyond him. You have to gauge his capacity. You have to think, is he capable of that which I would like to be able to tell him? Many people, and everyone for a certain period in his life, is incapable of things that are essential to their growth, but it's not yet time for them. I'm thinking, for example, of of a disciple whom I've mentioned to you on other occasions, who was a perfect peasant. He just had absolutely no class at all. It was worse than that. He had violence within him. He was capable of murder. He told me the story of once how, sitting on the bluff in Encinitas, he was sitting behind the children, and he had this almost irresistible urge to push one of them off the cliff, just for the sake of destroying. And he actually did that, and caught the child and pulled him back and laughed and said, oh, I was just kidding. But he was so frightened of himself when he saw this. He had it, and there wasn't much he could do about all that. It's really, in a way, amazing that Master took him. That shows something of the loyalty of a Master, that he will take his disciples of other incarnations because he's taken on that responsibility. The Master still will do everything he can because this person is part of his family now. But what Master said to me on the, about him, too, was he has great love. And it was that love that Master used to try to fan. Master didn't counsel him much. He didn't scold him ever, that I remember. He let him be himself because he knew that there was nothing that he would be able to accomplish on that way. This disciple wouldn't have understood. He'd have resented, whatever. But Master saw that here was the opening that he could use. And so he was thinking in terms of how he could help that person. Now, that's the next thing. You need to square yourself away to put out those kinds of vibrations that you need, because you're the first responsibility that you have in this universe. The greatest responsibility that the universe has dumped in your lap is you. But on the other hand, if you're able to be out of the picture and not think about yourself at all, because I don't mean to make you self-involved. I mean only to get you to that point where the energy you put out is positive and harmonious. But after that, it's a very good thing to forget yourself. It's a very good thing to help other people with the thought of helping them really. You will be able to do that to the extent that you have been able to get to your center, because it's only at your center that you can really rise above your own ego. It's only at your center that you can really expand yourself into others and reach them on the deepest level. But after that, you don't want to be thinking about yourself. You want to be thinking about, how can I really help this person? There are many things that that person needs to hear, but is he ready to hear them? An interesting psychological fact, it isn't always true, but it's dangerously often true, is that if you say something to somebody before he's ready to hear it, later, when he is ready to hear it, and you say it again, he'll think, oh, I've already heard that. And he'll give it less energy. Thus it is that it's very often helpful to hold your tongue until you feel this is the right time to say it. In my experience of life, and I have had quite a lot, and quite a lot of it negative in this respect, and I think I have a lot to share with you from the mistakes that I've made. I remember how Diamata used to call me on the carpet for being tactless and not thinking before I said. And I used to have this thought that if I say enough, I'll say the right thing. I found that it didn't work. I found that the safest thing of all is, if you're not pretty sure of what to say, don't say anything at all. And that hurts, because you know it. Something has to be said, but you have to feel it from inside. Consult your intuition. What I found is very helpful is, You see, people are wiser than they know. People are they're all children of God, and they have this wisdom locked up inside. But then the mind gets in the way, and they confuse the issue. If you will try to, instead of coming in with both feet, to sort of tell them where it's at, just listen quietly. And try to hear what their own higher self is saying to them, or what it's trying to say. You'll be surprised how, if you can really touch on that, you'll be able to say it in such a way that they'll say, oh yes, that's what I wanted to say. That's what I was thinking. It isn't quite what they were thinking, but they were and they weren't. Counseling is not so much to tell other people or to impose new ideas, it's to draw that wisdom out from the person himself. There's a group that I'm involved with right now in Italy that I've been thinking for days what to say to them to get a certain point across. And I'm painfully aware, it's very painful to me because I want them to see the truth of a situation. But I'm painfully aware that I cannot. It's not my right to say it. It's not my prerogative. It wouldn't help them. They've got to say it. It has to come from their own understanding. Otherwise, they will just put up a barrier, and then that barrier will always be there against that thought. And so I can't say it. Sometimes you have to let it come from other people. Diamata told a very interesting story. When she was a young girl, 17 years old, Master had her in a group in his quarters there, and he was just playing, took a piece of paper and rolled it up into a dunce cap, and once he'd made it, he said, Faye, come over here. He wanted to put this dunce cap on her. He must have known inside. It was a deep complex with her. She'd always felt that she hadn't been very bright in school because she wasn't really interested in intellectual knowledge, but she'd also had this complex, and she wasn't about to let him put a dunce cap on her head. And he said, come here. No. She wouldn't do it. And so finally he dismissed everybody but her, and he said, you sit there until you say yes. And he was really firm. You'd wonder, why would he be so firm about a little thing like that? But the thing is that much more was involved than that. Well, she finally broke into tears and came and put her head down so that he could put the dunce cap on her, and he didn't put it on. He just patted her on the head and said, go to your room. But later he said to her that if you had not obeyed me at that time, you would have left the path. This little bit of rebellious attitude would have gradually increased, and finally you would have gotten out of tune and just gone. And he said something else interesting. He said that when she was sitting there, he could see Satan on her left and Divine Mother on her right, each equally pulling. And when she made that decision, he saw Divine Mother reach out in blessing and Satan disappear. And he said, I knew then that you would make it in this lifetime. But what a strange thing to the average counselor that if it was all that crystal clear to him, he didn't say it in the first place. If there was that much at stake, why couldn't he say, look, I'm not talking to you about a dunce cap. I'm talking to you about your whole future. And if you don't obey me now, then why didn't he say it? Because he couldn't, because it would have been taking the plum right out of her mouth. She'd never have gotten the fruit. There are certain things that we've got to do ourselves. And your concern for other people isn't that he lacked love for her. He had a great deal of love. But your concern for other people must not be expressed to the extent that you do their lessons for them. Parents who do their lessons for their children aren't really helping their children. Their children get good grades, but what have they learned? We can't be sparing people their tests. It's only with those that they can grow, and sometimes it just tears your heart out. Because you know what's at stake, and you know what suffering they're opening themselves to if they make the wrong choice. And yet still you have no choice at all, except to respect their freedom to grow in their own way. Does that mean that you shouldn't say anything at all? No, that's where intuition comes in. That's why you can't make a science of it. It's got to be an art in the sense that you have to be intuitive. You have to consult your inner self. You have to consult their higher self. And then you have to look for that way which will be the most helpful. There are three rules of thumb you can put together into one rule, if you like, for helping other people. One is, never talk when they are upset, because you'll never get through to them. They will cloud everything that you say by their emotions, and the reason will always twist it in such a way as to misunderstand your meaning, your very words. So wait until they're calm. The second rule of thumb is, never talk when you are upset, because you will say things you don't mean, and if you don't, even if you don't use the wrong words, you'll have the wrong tone of voice. I said I loved you, didn't I? It sounds lovely, doesn't it? The tone of voice is just as much of a message as anything else. The body language, the expression of your eyes, you won't be able to hide it all, especially from people that you are close to. You'll say, what's wrong? Nothing. Come on, what's wrong? Nothing at all, nothing at all. Do they really mean nothing? Don't talk when you're upset. Try to don't suppress your anger, for example, if that's what it is. But you won't be suppressing it if you tell yourself, I'm putting it on a shelf, and I'll wait until I'm calm, and then I'll handle it. You'll suppress it if you say, oh, I never can talk because he never lets me, and you just bottle it up, and you say, oh, well, all right, and then it just gets a sort of a seething mass of frustration inside yourself. But if you just say, that's all right, I'm not ready to talk about it, but I will when I can look at it, then you're not suppressing it, and it's fine. In fact, essential, because you'll only hurt things if you talk in under the influence of emotion. So let's say that he's calm and you're calm. Then you have to think, well, four things. I said three. This will be four. The first of these is it something that he needs to hear? Will it help him? There are a lot of things that you could say that might have helped you, but they won't help him. I remember one of the disciples, he was very eager to please people. And I was making a big thing of not wanting to try to please people and not centering my sense of fulfillment or gratification or acceptance in other people's acceptance of me. And this was a good thing for me to do. And I saw him running up and down, doing things for everybody and basking in their pleasure. And I said, I found it very helpful not to think so much about other people. Master was out at the time, and the moment he came in, he looked at me and he said, it's my job to counsel these people, not yours. And I realized it was very interesting. He knew what I'd been saying, of course, he was a master. But I had been talking for what was helpful to me, and projecting onto him, thinking, therefore, it must be helpful to him. But that wasn't the case in his situation. That desire to please people was a quality he needed to grow on toward other things. And without that desire to please people, he would have been perfectly selfish. So in fact, for him, although a transitory virtue in itself, it's not a virtue, it was a transitory virtue in the sense that it was helping him to get out of something else. But Master knew that's what he needed, and he told him that. I found that also other people on the path, seniors on the path to me, on my path, and so on, they've given me advice directly counter to what Master said to me. And the reason for the difference was simply that what was right for them wasn't right for me. What he was giving me was what I needed to know and do in order to grow toward my particular salvation. Each one of us is different, so you need to think not only what do you feel to say, but what will help him to say. And then, finally, you have to think, what is he ready to hear? It may be some advice that he needs desperately, but if he isn't ready to hear it, don't waste your breath. It's more than a waste. It's putting up a barrier toward further comprehension later on. You may have to wait years, but remember, we're in a long-term thing. If you really love people, you have to think of it that way, that it can take lifetimes to overcome even one major, major fault. And so always look for that particular avenue that will be the most helpful at the time that it'll be the most helpful. Very often, And it's a very tricky thing. Very often just talking it out is not going to do it. They may see it, but that doesn't change anything. They think they've understood it because they've seen it. That doesn't change anything either. If you can put them in a situation where they will be forced to put out that kind of energy, that's the best way of all. When for example, here is a very simple thing to understand. Somebody who's lazy, you can talk to him about laziness and about how good it would be to do things, and he'll say, "Yeah, I know," and he takes another beer out of the icebox and sits back and watches another TV program. And you can talk about this for ages, years, and he'll still be the same fellow, probably becoming gradually a fat slob. But supposing, on the other hand, you find that he has an enjoyment for some particular activity. It could be anything, skiing, let's say. And instead of just talking about it, you go to him and say, "Well, let's go skiing." That gets him out there, and he comes back and he says, "Wow, that was fun." And it's done a great deal more toward getting him out of being lazy than just talking about it. Well, this is true on many, many different lines of behavior. If you can find a situation where you can get someone to do something that will push him in the direction that he needs to grow, that will mean a great deal more than merely pointing it out to him. This is the disadvantage with most counseling sessions, because the position of the counselor is not the position of a person who has control over your life. He can be there for that little half hour listening to your problems and giving a few pearls of wisdom, maybe, but he isn't in the position, for example, of a guru or a parent or somebody who can, even as a friend, say, "Come on, let's do so-and-so." Try to think what you can do to involve your friends in those things that are the most meaningful. Don't be an armchair philosopher. Get out there and actually get involved with them. Get involved in helping them to do the things that you want them to be. Doing in this sense precedes being, just as being also in its own way precedes doing. Each sort of like feedback between microphone and loudspeaker gradually build up into something, an unbeatable combination. And so, when you're trying to counsel people and help them, be economical, be concerned for their welfare, be economical in what you say, don't say it too often. If you speak a thing too often, it has much less power than if you say it once at just the right moment. Very often, example will do it far better than anything else. And it's a long haul, but then we're in it for the long haul, aren't we? If we think of attaining ultimate enlightenment, an example of charity, of kindness, of compassion, of humility, this will be far better than telling other people to be humble, let's say. Their inevitable response would be, "Who are you to talk?" Because in the very act of telling them that, you're not being humble, or at least it doesn't look like humility. If you can simply be humble, it is unfortunately exasperating how slowly people who are in the opposite fault ever get any good lesson from you. Because they will only see your humility, if they're totally egotistical, they'll only see your humility as a negative quality. They won't see it as a virtue. So, example, it may not work very quickly, it may not work at all, but it is certainly the most important of all these various ways of helping other people. Be first that which you want others to become. Then, even if you speak, you'll be able to speak in a different way. There'll be power in your speech. There's a good story of Mahatma Gandhi, who was approached by a woman one time, who asked him to tell her little boy to not eat sweets so much. And Gandhi said, "Well, let him come back next week." So the little boy came back next week, and Gandhi said to him, "Don't eat so many sweets." And the mother said, "Well, you could have said that to him last week. Why did you have to wait a week?" And he said, "Yes, but last week I too was eating too many sweets. I had to give it up first myself." That kind of, incidentally, that kind of humorous attitude toward things, that kind of non-attachment is a very important part of helping people. They will be much more likely to respond if they don't feel that you've put all your eggs in that basket of getting them to respond. If they feel that it's desperately important to you, they're much less likely to do it than if they feel that, well, take it or leave it, but I think it'll help you. If they don't feel an attachment in you, the humorous response is often good. For instance, that lovely response of Gandhi's, since we mentioned him. Somebody asked him, what do you think of Western civilization? He said, I think it would be a good idea. The attitude of being able to see the humor of a thing. If you take a thing too seriously, the other person is likely to think, oh, come on, it's not that bad. And finally, he'll just discount it altogether. A humorous attitude, too, is a very good way. This is something that Yogananda did, not only through humor, but you see, when the mind is still, that's when when the superconscious can become active. That's when you can counsel. That's when a truth can enter in. And so he would sometimes scold a person, perhaps, or talk in a way that was totally unrelated to any reality that that person could imagine. And that person would just sort of, wait a minute, what's this? And in the stunned surprise that he felt, his mind would stop. And in that moment when his mind was still, then Yogananda would say what he really wanted to say. It's a very interesting, he was a master psychologist, and he didn't go to school to learn it. He did it, he learned it by his compassion with people and his knowledge of himself, both. There was a lovely couple of stories that were that took place in his school in Ranchi. One was this boy who was a smoker, and he used to smoke on the sly. And Master said to him, I don't mind if you smoke, but I only want you to smoke. Whenever you feel the urge to smoke, smoke when I'm there. Come and smoke with me. So that he wouldn't feel that he was doing something clandestine. And so he went and smoked with Master a couple of times, but he felt so embarrassed smoking in Master's presence that finally he had to give it up. Another one was where there were two boys who were always fighting. You know that story, I think? Counseling didn't seem to help them, so finally he put them in the same bed, made them sleep in the same bed, and it was either constant war or enforced peace. And so they finally managed to somehow stop beating each other up, at least. And so they seemed fairly good friends. In fact, their friendship was growing, but he decided to give it a further test. Now, why does a master test you? He tests you to bring out of you qualities or responses that will affirm what you need to learn. It isn't that he's curious and needs to find out where you are. He knows where you are. So Master waited until they were asleep, and then he stood at the head of their bed, and he reached down with his knuckles and rapped one of them on the forehead like this. That one got, why did you do that to me like this, to the other boy? And the boy said, I didn't do anything. What are you talking about? I was asleep. All right. So they got back to sleep again. Then Master waited until they were sound asleep. Then he reached down to the other one and rapped him on the front. I told you I didn't do anything like this. And oh, you. They saw him there. And he said from then on they were the best of friends because he'd brought that last little bit of pus out of the wound. And then it healed completely. Well, that's master psychology. You have to recognize, however, and this is something that you can learn from that, which is that sometimes a sense of humor, a sense of a realization that we're, it's sort of like a cooking recipe. The finished product that you're cooking is your own ego, and you're trying to not only cook it, but burn it away. But anyway, the recipe is something that we're concerned with at the moment, not the final product of disintegration and incineration. And so you take ingredients like anger, like devotion, like forgiveness, like a desire to serve other people, a desire to please other people, like a wish to do good deeds and help people, across the street or in pain or heal them if they're sick or whatever it might be. You take all of these things and you sort of mix them together in the right proportions. If they get too much of one, then other good virtue, other virtues might be starved. Maybe success, in fact, quite obviously, success means balance, means being a total human being. And it's only at that point that we can say that we have, that we can enter into the kingdom of God. I remember Master saying to me one time, all the various things that you've been working on have balanced out in this life, and this is the life that you can find God. That was a wonderful thing to hear. But think of all the things, think of the process of balancing out. Think of how the guru has to play with this quality and that, and this one gets too much, and so he puts you in something that may be totally opposite. If he'd been the guru of Michelangelo, he might have put him out planting corn. Because he was much more, he'd have been much more concerned with his spiritual growth than with his artistic production. And so, when you're helping people, you need to think in terms of balance also. Supportive counseling. That kind of thing which is really out to help them and not just trying to correct a situation, needs to look at the chemistry of feeling, the chemistry of psychology, the chemistry of thoughts, and recognize how a combination of two qualities, they might even be faults, but in combination might become a virtue. I can't think of an example, but please imagine for me. The ability to stand back from it and say, oh, this would help him, and that would hurt him, even though it might be good in some context. Like an actor who has a very strong ego, if he's on the spiritual path, his guru might well tell him not to act. Where another person who hasn't got that problem, acting would be a way of helping to bring out of himself a certain commitment to a certain personality, a certain narrow focus, whatever it might be. There could be great spiritual gains in acting if the attitude was right. But look at people with a sense of humor, which is to say with a sense of proportion. That's really what it's about. Not with attachment. You'll be able to help them if you can talk without attachment, if you'll be able to talk obviously with the thought of their welfare, and therefore, well, how does it say in the Bhagavad Gita? Nishkam karma. Action without desire for the fruits of action, desireless action. If you can counsel in that way, leaving the fruits of your counseling in the other person's hands as to whether he accepts it or not, he'll be much more likely to accept it than if you try to force it on him. In fact, a very wholesome attitude, and it's one that I've developed in myself deliberately over the years because I've seen it very, very valid, is to realize and always remember that nobody owes it to me to accept anything that I tell him. You know how people are? They I've told you this, why don't you listen kind of attitude. They don't owe it to you. Rather, they bless you if they accept what you've given them, because they make it valid. They give you good karma for having done something good. So it's really, it's not their duty to heed you. Offer it with total freedom as to whether they accept or not, and it will hurt you terribly if you see that they refuse good counsel. But everybody has to learn in his own way, and sometimes that which seems like very negative, a very negative experience, may indeed be an experience that was needed. I can imagine, for example, somebody who has a problem with drinking. And obviously, the worst thing for him would be to become an alcoholic. The best thing for him would be to give up drinking. But let's say, just for the sake of argument, let's say that if he doesn't become an alcoholic and really get this whole thing out of his system, he's likely to go on for incarnation just getting pleasantly stoned, or is that the right word? Anyway, drunk. Whereas if he really were to have a good blow-off for one lifetime and become a hopeless drunk, maybe that would give him enough firmness to get out of that particular way of behavior forever. Maybe. I certainly don't want to recommend it to anybody. But when you see somebody going that way, it may help you as sort of a means of preventing yourself from judging him. Because who really knows where a person is? Sometimes a person might be very close to God and just have one major fault to overcome. And other people who seem to be so virtuous may have so many petty faults that it may take them 1,000 incarnations to even get out of them, what to speak of developing a few real virtues. Somebody who loves God is much closer to God, even if he has a mountain of faults, than somebody who has a mountain of virtues but doesn't love God. The one canceling, all-canceling virtue is devotion. And in fact, the greatest thing that you can help people to do is to love God more deeply. The greatest example that you can set for others is to be a real devotee. They may not understand, they may resent. In fact, it's perfectly common for people when they come on the spiritual path for their relatives to get all upset with this fanaticism. And it's so funny, because if you became a drunk, they'd all just sort of say, oh, tut, tut, too bad. When they really fight you is when you try to be better than they are. At least that's the way they see it. But if you will just keep going quietly, loving God, you may find that you upset them, and you may find that you can't help them. And I look back at the letters that I wrote my parents when I was new on the path, and I cringe with embarrassment, because I realized it was absolutely the wrong thing to say. It would never draw them, and it sort of put them off, quite. But you will find that if you really sincerely follow, and your example is misunderstood for many years, if you just quietly live the way you have to live, not living that way to impress anyone, but just to be what you know you want to become, you will find that over a period of time that influence will take hold. That vibration of centeredness, of peace, of whatever it might be, they'll take it in. They won't talk about it, perhaps less to you, but you'll find that in some subtle way over the years their lives are changing. I've seen that with my relatives, most of whom have totally rejected this way. And yet over the years I find them more and more in tune with this way. The influence has been there. The greatest thing if you want to help other people is to really change yourself. If you want to change the world, change yourself.